Comics Therapy, Episode 8. No reviews, just analysis. So after my rant about gender roles last week, I'm taking over. This episode is for the ladies. Today, we'll be discussing three books from September 11th, 2013. Red Sonja number 3, X-Men number 5, and Rachel Rising number 19. Notice a theme? We'll do some pretty in-depth analysis, or we like to think we do. And we're definitely going to get into spoiler territory, so go read, then come back and listen to the show. For grief counseling, we're going to talk about Volume 5 of The Walking Dead, containing issues 25 through 30. And for Erin's inner child, well, we'll see how that goes in a bit.
Hi, this is Leslie. I'm Latlansky on Twitter. My nerd confession is my library has an amazing comic selection, so most of the trades that I read come from the library. I have discovered that if I get on the wait list early enough for most of the Marvel books, we can put things on hold at the library before they even come out, they have them on order. If I do that early enough, I can usually get a copy that still has the digital code in it, so I can score myself some free comics. It kind of feels like stealing, but I figure if I don't use the code, some other library patron is, so if it works for me, I might as well take it. That's my confession.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Andrea nor I is a licensed, anything, probably? I don't know, I might have some license. Oh, I'm a licensed minister.
No, you're not, really?
Yeah.
As in, like, you can perform a wedding ceremony? That's not the same.
Yeah.
Really? Yeah. Okay, carry on.
Anyway. We're certainly not therapists, and we'll be talking about the female problem this week.
Watch it.
don't take any of the following banter as serious medical advice or a reasonable example of how two grown adults respectfully speak to one another. We'll be lucky to keep this civil.
In between segments, your very own nerd confessions. Itching to get a deep, dark, geeky secret off your chest, like maybe you blew off comics this week to watch The West Wing instead. Then leave us a message, and we'll feature it on an upcoming episode of the show. All the details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. Remember, catharsis is cool.
If you're looking for us outside the show, I'm on Twitter at Erin Myers, and Andrea's at Andrea Shock. The show account is at Comics Therapy.
Erin, dear, before this devolves into me just yelling at you, how was your week?
A lot of work. I was doing some more prep for Rose City Comic Con. There's a lot more creators announced and pulling stuff and organizing and figuring things out. My wife is allowing me to go both days now.
Wow, so, I didn't see that yesterday. Good job, Chrissy.
So that kind of changes how the schedule and things will be for me. I won't have to like rush around in one day. I can kind of meet up with people and see things and maybe even go to panels like I normally wouldn't. I wouldn't normally go to any panels at a con because I just don't have time.
Change from the way that you do cons now that you're, since the boys were born, so that you have to be more sparing with your time there? I guess, in other words, did you go to panels and things in cons before you had other obligations at home?
In San Diego, we went to them sometimes, but like San Diego, I also wasn't really into comics like I am now, so it wasn't quite the same priority. Like a lot of the panels just wouldn't have appealed to me because I didn't know anything about it.
Gotcha.
You know, we went to like the mainstream panels, which were kind of fun, but you know, really all the cons that I started going to came around the same time as the kids were born. And I always felt like I needed to kind of be home before late in the afternoon. And, you know, the cons are all in Portland, so that's a 2-hour drive. So I never really even considered going to, like, panels or meeting up with people, you know, who weren't creators or something, and just kind of hanging out for a little bit.
So are you going to be able to stay in Portland, or are you going to go up and back?
No, I'll go up and back, which, you know, kind of a lot of driving, but I don't really mind the drive that much. I could stay in Portland, but for me, I feel too guilty about doing that.
That's fair.
At least, you know, I'll get to go during the day for 2 days, and that's not that bad.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so that I have to kind of figure out how I'm going to do it, because now I'm used to kind of a very regimented schedule if I'm going to a con, to try to pack in as much as possible. But now with time, I'm not sure how to spontaneously relax, you know? Like,
wow, it doesn't surprise me in the slightest that you might have difficulty relaxing.
Well, I don't know how to, like, kind of then just kind of have a time just to walk around. I mean, I'm going to try just to do that, you know, and not be so like, okay, I got to go here, and now I got to go here.
Yeah, I think that would be really good for you.
We'll just
wander.
Makes me nervous to think about relaxing.
Also unsurprising.
Did you see Top Shelf Comics has this big sale going on?
I did. I didn't have a chance to go through it, but definitely noticed that a bunch of people were talking about it yesterday. And they have some really lovely all-ages things, so...
Yeah, we just loaded up on... I just placed it this morning. I grabbed a bunch of all the all-ages books that we didn't have. Because they're like 50 to 90% off right now.
Right. So when does the sale end?
I think it goes for like a week or two, but things start dropping off the list when they sell out of them.
Sure.
So it's better to do it sooner than later. And I got a new microphone. Hopefully it sounds better.
Good job. I did not. We had a little bit of a difficult week from the family side of things, so I didn't get my new microphone, but hopefully soon. And in the meantime, maybe my old microphone is a better strategy than the slapdash method that I operated under last week.
Yeah, we'll see.
Talking loudly into the laptop, not quite the same.
Yelling at the computer.
Right.
Well, what else has been happening this week?
We're more settled than we have been, right? Every day is better. School is going. I guess this is the first week that we've had more of a routine, and that is starting to feel nice. So Avi goes to school, and I'm still working from home, and it's been like a more kind of regular set of days, except that, you know, now my partner's out of town, and it's a little bit more complicated. So I think in the next couple of weeks, we'll really start to feel like we're home. But the sweetest thing is that I have amazing neighbors. That is not ever a guarantee, right? Like, you move into a new neighborhood and maybe everyone is a psychopath, but nope, so far so good. We had neighbors bring us wine. We had neighbors make us apple crisp. It's rather lovely here.
That sounds suburban.
It's shut up. I know. It is. But honestly, I'm at the point in my life where I'm not ashamed to be comfortable for the sake of my family. I worked really hard to get here. So I made the choice, I think, that it's okay. It's okay to maybe pick a decent neighborhood with a decent school for my kid.
Yeah, I don't think that's something you have to feel guilty for.
It is something that I felt, maybe guilty is the wrong word, but it is something that took me longer than I expected to kind of reconcile from the way that we had been living before versus the opportunities that we have now. I think it's possible that it took me a while to like realize that. I was reasonably young when Avi was born. I was 26, I think. So the like growing up that you do in your late 20s, like as a person, and what is acceptable and what you yearn for as a then somebody in your mid-30s, it shifts. And so I don't feel guilty. That's totally the wrong word. But it has been a recentering of priorities with the move and everything, just from like the big move out to the Bay Area. So...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, the next stage in life is like RV. You know, you retire, you buy an RV.
No.
Get matching tracksuits.
No. I don't really see that happening.
Start doing a tour of Cracker Barrels of the Midwest.
Although we did have a really fantastic time both times we drove across the country last summer. So there's a little bit of that is appealing, but not anytime soon.
Well, you got like 20 years.
Really? That's the cutoff? 20 years?
Yeah, you know, in your 50s, that's when you start doing your death tour of the United States.
God, that's so depressing.
Yeah. You don't have to worry about it right now.
20 more years. Okay.
Yeah. Let's talk about some comics.
Last week, I gave you 90 seconds to talk about whatever you wanted. That was a mistake. I was weak. I did not enforce the rules. So, Aaron, your inner child needs some discipline, okay? You need to make some choices. When Avi went to preschool, he learned you get what you get and you don't throw a fit. So you have 90 seconds to talk about one book, just one. One new comic that you read this week that we're not going to analyze, but that, like, made the kid in you jump for joy and you got all giddy and cute about it. Are you ready?
I guess.
What comic? You don't have to announce it as part of your 90 seconds. So what comic are you going to let Aaron's inner child just fanboy about?
Sons of Anarchy, number one.
Okay. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Go.
Okay. Well, Sons of Anarchy, have you ever watched the TV show?
Nope.
Okay. It's my, like, guilty pleasure TV show because it's both, like, horrible and wonderful in almost every way. It's just so, I don't even know. It's just a dumb biker drama, but it's really good in that, like, bad sort of way. So I really love the TV show, and so Boom Studios came out with the comic book, which is usually like comic books based on TV shows, especially, like, if they're not sci-fi or something like that, are kind of that's not going to be any good. But this is pretty good. It's good in the way that the TV show is good, which is good for a comic to be able to accomplish. It's hard to kind of establish that same sort of feeling. And, you know, the creative team did a good job. The artist is pretty good. It's, you know, it's terrible, but it's really good and it's fun to read. And I don't know, I guess that's my inner child, although I don't know if I want my inner child to be reading or watching Sons of Anarchy.
What makes it terrible, though? Is it just, like, cheesy?
Yeah, kind of cheesy and kind of trashy, and, you know, it's a drama, but, gotcha. You know, it's like a soap opera drama with bikers and hookers and drugs.
5 seconds.
That sort of thing. That's what every child wants.
Hookers?
Yeah, hookers and bikers and drugs. And
man, this just took a turn for the worst.
How was that? It's hard for me to talk about one thing for 90 seconds.
I know, that's the point. It's a challenge for you.
Oh, I see. Is this therapy for me?
This is absolutely. Don't even begin to make the connection that this is your grief counseling. This is like fucking baby steps in comparison. Wow. When we get to that today. Okay.
Wait.
Okay, I'm done.
We got a lot to talk about before we get to that.
Why don't we start?
Hi, Aaron. Hi, Andrea. This is Joe Patrick, one half of the Two-Headed Nerd Radio Empire. And this is my comics confession. I'm not that fond of Watchmen. In fact, I'm not that fond of Alan Moore in general. I've disliked far more of his works than I've liked. And I don't know what's wrong with me. I've tried many things. I've tried most things. Some things that I'd never recommend to anyone. Necronomicon, don't read it. But I just can't get into Alan Moore. He's got a couple of bright shining stars, but otherwise, the man just doesn't do it for me. Thanks, guys. Hopefully I'm not beyond help.
Our first book this week is Red Sonja number 3. It's published by Dynamite Entertainment, and it's written by Gail Simone, art by Walter Giovanni.
If you're unfamiliar with this character, Red Sonja is a female warrior. She's a master hunter. In this newest volume, she's helping a king to whom she owes a debt, a king whose people are infected with plague and marked for death by a group of, let's call them, spirited vigilantes. Infected with plague herself, Sonja is exiled from the realm in exchange for her surrender to the leader of the attackers, a warrior woman from Sonja's past. This issue delves into her backstory, Sonja's. backstory, her origin as a hunter and a killer, a warrior in her own right. And she's lying, like, feverish and plague-ridden in the far, far north.
Yeah. So, for me, I think this is the best issue so far of this. And this really was, like, a turning point for me on the series. We, if anyone cares to search it out, Andrea and I were both guest hosts on the Burnt Wieners podcast, I guess, 10 weeks ago.
Yeah, right before we started this little game.
Yeah, right before we started our show. So I guess that's when the first issue came out. We talked about it on that show. And I think we had very different feelings then than I did, at least with this issue. This really clicked with me.
Okay, I have to separate the two ways that I felt about this. I agree that in terms of the first three issues of this particular volume of this story, this was the most interesting. It was the most sympathetic, it was character-driven, and hooray. But I don't take back any of the things that I said 10 weeks ago about Sonya. And the way that she is traditionally portrayed, and this goes vastly beyond this particular volume of her story. I have such a difficult time understanding. I can't get past the way that she's dressed. I know that sounds so surfacey, but I've been thinking a lot about this, and I've been trying to come up with a way to articulate why I can't get past it. So there's two sides. There's the historical and kind of cultural, the functional development of clothing. And then on the other side, you've got costume design, which has a lot of freedom to take elements of the historical and the cultural and make it more character-oriented and play around with it. And it's like the whole theatrical aspect of the design. Mm-hmm. And in the Venn diagram of those two for Sonya, it's two fucking circles. I mean, it's like a visual metaphor for her breasts. There's no overlap there between what would make sense historically or culturally for a kind of realm that she lives in and the functional things that she needs to do as a warrior and then the way that she's dressed all the time. I don't get that.
Well, I think this is the problem when you start debating the literature of comics versus the business side of comics. Like, the problem with Red Sonja is, traditionally, guys were buying, you know, in everyone, probably almost every issue up until this Gail Simone series, 90%, 95% of the people buying Red Sonja books are male.
Okay.
Traditionally, from the first issue that she appeared in, she has been dressed like that.
Absolutely, so, and she's not the only one. I understand that. And there is a male equivalent as well. I mean, look at the way that Conan dresses. And, I mean, honestly, look at, like, He-Man and She-Ra. It's the kid version of that
yeah, there's a
little
there's
world.
A fantasy style, especially, like, a Bronze Age fantasy style of garb that continues to this day. And it's definitely a female problem, though. Because, like, I don't look at Conan and say, like, well, why is he in a loincloth? Why isn't he wearing something?
Why? Is it just because I have, I don't know. Is it my fault? Because that, I look at that and I think the same thing.
Because men dressed like that, dressed in a similar way, like a Conan, aren't sexualized like women are. You know, it's the difference between looking at a man as a man who is, you know, muscly and powerful and identifying with him,
mm-hmm.
versus seeing a woman like Red Sonja and then lusting after her.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, but then in the story, we're supposed to take her at face value as this masterful warrior and what? Keep the lust part on the down low? Because that's
That is part of the appeal traditionally of Sonya, is that she is, you know, she's beautiful. Every man wants her, but no man can have her. There's sort of I guess if you really want to boil it down, there's a bit of like a masochism element to her because she is unobtainable.
Right. And so that's why it's such a violation to have her surrender, why she has like, she's so tormented by that because it's one of the things that she would never do, right? She's unattainable, and she will never surrender, and she will fight to the death, and blah, blah, blah. And
yeah, I think there is, like, prior to this Gail Simone relaunch, I haven't read a ton of Red Sonja, but I've read some, and I think, like, what she would say in the past is, the only man who will ever know me is the man who can defeat me.
Mm-hmm.
And no man has ever defeated her, so therefore, no man has ever had her.
Right.
Which is, you know, that's a pretty packed statement in terms of, like, gender and sexuality and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there, it's like, the man who can conquer me can have his way with me.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not entirely sure how I feel about that.
No, that's... I don't think it's fair to say that is just a male fantasy.
Explain.
Well, I mean, this is too generalized, but I've had conversations with women in the past where it's... There's fantasies surrounding being overtaken.
Are we talking about rape fantasies, Aaron?
Yeah, but not even quite so far as that. But sure, I mean, it falls within that line. But that's the difference between fantasy and reality, too.
Okay.
I mean, those same conversations that I've had are fantasy. They're not actually hoping, like, I get raped. But it's fun,
sure,
to act out fantasies in terms of that with somebody that is safe.
Because in that particular case, by its very definition, the conversation happens ahead of time. It's actually about giving control rather than having control being taken from you.
So I think going back to the character, I think that is an aspect of Sonja's, not persona, but character base, that there's a lot of that gets played out in her stories.
Okay.
But which is different than the Conan side. She's not a female analog of Conan.
Agreed. I was making the comparison as a more general one related to the kind of fantasy genre, less about the character specifically. But still, how do you reconcile that with the audience being traditionally male? And do you think, because I haven't read other examples of Red Sonja, I have a very vivid memory of seeing a movie. I don't even know how many poor movies of Red Sonja have been made. But definitely there was one that we rented in the early or mid-80s.
Yeah, I think it came out not too long after Conan the Barbarian.
Right. And so that was my exposure to it. I don't know, maybe I was 9 or 10. My cousins were in town. I have all of these stories of bad movie exposure as a child, now that I think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Different cousins in this case. And I'm not afraid of, female warriors as a result of seeing this movie when I was probably too young. So take that as you will. But I had that image, and I had the knowledge, even as a kid, that the movie was shit. And so it was kind of laughable. But that was my sense of Red Sonja. So reading these last three issues hasn't done a ton to dispel that. Like, okay, here we go. This is a little bit more suspension of disbelief than I'm willing to give for this particular style of story. But I think it's so much of it has to do with the way that she's presented physically. Because I think it does such a disservice to, like, what she's capable of in terms of her actions and in terms of her belief system and how she presents herself and the trials and tribulations that she has gone through in her life. And then she's hanging out in a chainmail bikini. It from a character standpoint, I just don't understand it.
Yeah, no, I can definitely understand that. To me, though, like, from my perspective, it didn't even really click that much for me. Like, I think in my brain, and it's just a different way of approaching how this character speaks to us on a gendered level.
Mm-hmm.
I think still the people that buy these books are going to be male. I think a lot more females are reading the Gail Simone series because she's writing it.
Right.
But it still has mandate to stick to, her typical origins and
that's
traditional things that they would expect to see from her.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with its existence, and I'm not proposing that we change everything for the sake of it being more authentic to what exactly. It's not real. It is a fantasy story with some very classic fantasy elements. That will continue to be something that I can't ignore. It is like literally me judging the book by its cover. And I'm okay with that in some cases.
It's kind of funny, though. I was looking at this cover in particular, which has nothing really to do with the story. And it's just a very, you know, it's a Cheesecake Red Sonja cover. Like, mm-hmm. She looks hot. She's fighting dudes on a battlefield, like, mm-hmm. doing a backflip. So her, you know, her breasts are exposed. And it's like, that is, you know, no different than any other Red Sonja cover you've seen for the last, you know, 20 years.
Right. Now, luckily, in this particular case, the comic that's actually awaiting inside, I think is a little different. And I think the origin story I thought was very appealing. I think that giving her a little bit more humanity, I mean, she's still so like supernatural in her ability and her exploits, but, and even as a child, as we see what she's able to accomplish in this issue, but still giving her the sadness that rooted her development, it was very poignant. There were some moments.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
No, I agree with that. I thought it was a very good origin story issue. I think this will play. This also makes the previous issues even more interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, to see now what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the fall and then the rise.
Right.
Is a good story arc, and yeah. I think that helps define the character too for maybe what happens after. Because
mm-hmm.
I think we even talked about this. I don't know how long Gail Simone is writing this series for, but my guess would be like 6 issues.
Yeah, I think that's what we predicted. It was likely to be just the first arc.
But if this is supposed to be a different kind of main story title and whoever takes it over after that, they should be writing the next arc based upon how she defines this version of the character.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with this origin story especially defines her. She's a lot more filled out.
Yes.
Without, you know, no pun intended.
If you weren't going to say it, I probably was. So there
right.
you go.
I figured I'd get to it first. So I like this a lot. This really appealed to me. And then it just made my feelings about the first two issues even kind of more enhanced and kind of different perspective on them, mm-hmm. I think, too. Which is how a series should be. Like, a first issue, your impressions of a first issue should hopefully change or get only reaffirmed as the series goes on. Like every, you know, an issue is not static in itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's, I think we've filled out as much as we can about that, right?
Yeah. I don't know. You could probably get one more of those in here, or maybe we can just talk about it with some of the ladies in the later issues. For the day.
Yeah, there's plenty of time to fill out more.
Yeah.
Fill outs.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Let's move on.
Cameron Williams, Wasgo from Twitter, and my nerd confession is I don't like it when indie darlings end up on Marvel books because I don't think a lot of them do a great job writing in the Marvel style. And I end up preferring books from guys that have been at Marvel for a long time over the latest and greatest indie guys.
Up next, X-Men number 5. Written by Brian Wood with art by David Lopez. It's published by Marvel Comics. This is part 3 of Battle of the Atom.
Battle of the Atom is bringing together events from All New X-Men, Uncanny X-Men, and Brian Wood's X-Men. This is all still dealing with the after effects of Avengers vs. X-Men last year when Cyclops killed Xavier and new mutants started popping up all over again. The original X-Men were brought to the current timeline. They basically refuse to go home, and some of them are hanging out at the Jean Grey school, and Angel defected to Cyclops' group. And in the most recent issue, there was a battle with the Sentinels that gravely injured the young Scott, and old Scott kind of disappeared and freaked everyone out. They're both fine now, but the urgency to send the original X-Men back grows stronger. It's culminating now in the arrival of a bunch of future X-Men who insist that the original X-Men return to their time ASAP because they're going to ruin everything. So we've got like 100 beasts running around, a whole bunch of Bobbies, at least 2 Jean Greys and Cyclopses, and Jubilee still has a baby.
Yeah, that's about it.
Yeah, good times.
Easy.
Right.
So you have been keeping up with most of the X-Men books?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I was behind with all new X-Men, I don't know, a month or so ago, but I'm all caught up now.
Okay. And I was talking to somebody last night, like, I'm really enjoying this this miniseries, but if you hadn't been reading all the X-Men books, it's going to be, I think, kind of confusing.
Kind of. A little bit.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on, which makes it for a cool event. It's nice to have kind of everything tie and come together that's been worked on for the last, you know, year and a half or so.
Sure, sure. I think it's interesting. I think the way that the relationships with the older and newer versions of the characters, and obviously especially Jean Grey, are really fascinating. And then when you throw Rachel into the mix with Brian Wood's X-Men, it is just a really fascinating interplay with mother, daughter, but sorta, not really. I mean, it there's some kind of nifty potential there.
Yeah, and it's aside from mutant powers, this is really a study, or it's sort of a what if of what happens when you know your future,
right?
And how would you change it? You know, especially when it comes to young Jean Grey,
mm-hmm.
knowing that she dies in the future, and partly because of her decisions and her relationship with Scott, and trying to maybe take a different path or exploring different paths.
Mm-hmm.
Here in the present, and then rejecting, like, I don't want, you know, saying I don't want to go back to the past because I know what happens. I want to stay here.
Yeah, I think that was a really important moment when several of the current faculty were. It was Kitty and Rachel, right, who said, mm-hmm. like, I don't think it's actually cool that we're making this decision to send them back if they don't want to go. And what are the implications of that, and how willing are we to intervene on their behalf?
Well, it's interesting, too, that they decided that it's okay, they should get to make the decision, because Beast made the decision to pull them into the future.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess they decided, yes, they would go, but, you know, it's sort of like somebody tempts you with the golden eggs, or here, step into my time machine, here's some candy, kids. You know, it's not really fair. I'm kind of tongue-tied on this, that it's weird to give them the decision now, but I guess at the same time, they should have the decision because so much has been revealed to them.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when they first stepped into the future, it was without a lot of knowledge of what might come.
Right.
And and even though Beast knew, like, pulling them into the future is, you know, a no-no. This is the one rule I don't break. And now we find out what can happen when stuff happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole, hey, if Cyclops, young Cyclops dies, old Cyclops dies. And if old Cyclops dies and young Cyclops die in the wrong time, a whole lot of stuff is going
to
break.
Yeah, there's a very Back to the Future kind of moment there with the, like, older Scott disappearing in front of them because the mm-hmm. younger Scott was dying, which I suppose makes sense.
It's
impossible for me not to think of Back to the Future, like the fading photograph and like playing the guitar and his hand is going away and effects in 1985 are so cheesy and awesome.
Well, there's also a nice art homage to when Jean Grey died as the Phoenix.
Yes.
And when Scott dies, you know, by the Sentinel, it's the same panel.
Right.
Which I thought was really... really kind of a cool, like, inside kind of thing, but also very true in what's happening, too.
So I think that the introduction of Jean from the future is, like, that makes things very muddy, and...
I think it's a reveal, though.
I think so, too. Who do you, like, how do I say this? Who do you think that Jean is?
I think Jean is Jean. I think if do you want my spoiler guess for the end of the series?
Yeah, dude, we put a whole warning at the beginning of the show.
So my guess is everyone goes back except for Jean.
Yeah, that's what I think too.
And that's how you get Jean Grey back into the Marvel Universe.
And I think that her age as the future Jean is the visual cue.
Yeah. Although she also says like her powers have grown and, you know, telepaths and people of her power, like she might not age, you know, who knows? There's tons of ways to explain that, like how she ages
but,
or whatever.
But I guess I went for the Occam's Razor version of the... That's what I bring to the table.
I'm not sure Occam's Razor is almost like doesn't apply to comic books. It's almost whatever the most complicated answer can be is the most likely when it comes to comics.
That's true. I think that there, like, that is a really exciting thing, though, bringing her back and keeping old Jean around so that then Jean Grey as an entity still exists in the universe. But there's so much potential with...
To do it right, though, you really have to deal with the ramifications of that. Like, if she stays, then none of the other stuff happens.
Wow.
I mean, it does, right? Like, she never becomes the Phoenix, which I guess she didn't
become the
Phoenix.
Wait, they can't undo all of that. They can't.
Well, that's right. But so what happens then? Because if she stays in the future...
Damn it. See,
none of that ever happens.
I liked it better when I hadn't thought about all of the specifics.
Which is maybe the problem. I mean, in the future, it's like because they decided to let them stay, the future looked pretty screwed up.
So then do you take back your prediction? Because...
No, I think
it sounds like that's the problem.
It might be a problem. I hope that Bendis and Wood and everyone else who's architecting this have a good way to explain all that deep continuity.
Because that's everything. That's back through.
Yeah, that's all of Claremont's. You know, that's the heyday of Claremont's X-Men, which is, you know, as core to X-Men these days as it is to anything. So we'll see, but that's my guess. It's just a tricky thing to write and not leave everyone going like, well, what about this? You know,
that was my guess too until about 2 minutes ago when I actually gave the implications of that a deeper consideration. So,
It might be also a way to get Professor X back into the Marvel Universe, because probably if Jean never dies and the Phoenix stuff never happens and all that thing, maybe Professor X doesn't die by Scott, but that would be a total reset.
That's a total reset of what? Like 20 years worth of stuff? I think we need to move on. I think I need to stop thinking about this or my head's going to explode.
This is why time travel is hard.
It's always bad news bears.
Hello, Comics Therapy. This is Paul O'Connor from the Longbox Graveyard blog. I had to think a bit to offer up a confession that I haven't already made. I've already disgraced myself at my blog by leaving Spider-Man and X-Men off my Marvel Comics top 10 list. I just don't like them all that much. But something I've kept locked away until now is I just don't really get comics artist Gil Kane. I mean, I know he's a grandmaster of the form. He's a significant artist on Spider-Man and lots of other titles. I know he has an artist edition from IDW. But I have to tell you, when I look at his work, all I can see are arched backs and up nostril shots. I mean, every comic artist recycles poses, but with Kane, it was like a disease, or maybe a fetish. I don't know. I'm telling you, man. Arch backs, up nostril shots. Once seen cannot be unseen. That's all you see. That's all you'll see from now on when you look at Kane, and that's all I've seen for decades. So, sorry, not a fan. I feel bad about it. That's why I'm confessing, you know, because Kane is a fan favorite and a giant and was probably a great guy and everything, but there I said it. All right. I feel better now. Thanks. Bye.
All right. Lastly, we've got Rachel Rising number 19 by Terry Moore, released by Abstract Studio.
This is a hard one to sum up, and we are talking about the current issue number 19. So if you If you are not reading this, you should be. But this minute worth of information about what has been covered is not nearly enough. But here we go. Rachel died, but then she came back, and that's happened a couple of times. Now it's happening to her best friend, Jet, and a couple of other people in this not-so-sweet small town of Mason. So hundreds of years ago, 300 years ago, Mason was the site of a horrific crime where all the unmarried women between 15 and 25 were hung for witchcraft, and their bodies were burned, and the ash fell like snow upon the village. One of the women, Lilith, is actually the first woman, but we're going to get more into that and what it means in a little bit. She'd been trying to teach some of the young ladies in Mason who possessed special gifts, like Rachel, who was not her original name, but we'll get to that in a moment also. Rachel can't remember the specifics of her past life, if you can call it that, but she knows that she's not interested in helping Lilith exact revenge on the entire current town of Mason as vengeance for the murders and hysteria of the town's young women 300 years ago. And also there's a demon hanging around. He's got his sights set on more than just Mason. He's using the town to set in motion the end of mankind as we know it.
There's also, there's a lot going on in this book. And this is my favorite Terry Moore book so far. But I've been a fan of his for a while. Like I kind of caught up on, I haven't nearly read all of it, but Strangers in Paradise I really liked, and mm-hmm. Echo I really like. And I really love his art, but this is sort of his masterpiece, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so tied to kind of a colonial sort of neo-Christian or Christian, you know, what am I trying to think of? Puritan Christian mythology.
Absolutely.
And how it's playing out in this town. It's such a slow burn, but it's so well executed. Like every little reveal and every little like peeling away the layer of this bigger story.
Mm-hmm.
Has been fantastic. It's really a great study on women in general and how women have been treated and are viewed throughout kind of history too.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of different aspects, like Rachel's, you know, aunt and her relationships.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of interplay there and the girls themselves, both in their past lives and their current lives. There's just it's such a hard book to describe other than you should read it. And it's nice. It's been optioned for a TV show. Who knows?
Oh,
if
really?
It'll actually be, yeah, I don't know if it'll actually become one, but I mean, it lends itself to a TV show really
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. It's so the serial nature and I think slow burn is a really accurate way to describe the reveals. Absolutely. The pacing is really appropriate for something weekly or whatever on TV.
Oh yeah, right. And he, the mark of a really good storyteller too, is not rushing ahead. You know, a book like this, I know has been struggling to get a lot of readers. I think after it was announced that the TV rights were sold, sales picked up a ton because mm-hmm. whether people are reading it or not, speculators buy the issues,
mm-hmm.
and then bought the back issues and buy the reprints. So that's good because it breathes life into a series that really might have had might be waffling on in terms of being successful. I know I'd seen him in the past say like, yeah, make sure you pre-order it because we need to get those pre-orders in to make sure we can afford to do this. And I think at this point it's fairly secured for a while. So hopefully we get to see how it all plays out. I don't know how long it's planning to go for,
mm-hmm.
but there definitely seems to be an arc and progression that leads to an endpoint, you know, somewhere down the road.
Yeah, I don't believe for a second that this isn't planned all the way to a final conclusion. There has been, it's too well crafted to be meandering. And there are some very specific choices that he's made with who or how he's introduced some of the mythology and some of the, like you said, the kind of Puritan historical like basis for what has happened in the town. And I'm sure that there's a master plan.
And from in terms of like talking about the women themselves, the different kind of aspects of the witches and the women, you know, from their past and who they were and what they were capable of. I think it's not revolutionary, but it's very interesting. It's great story building.
I think Lilith's role in this is less clear to me, intentionally. So that's not a complaint. It's an observation. The story of Lilith, let's go with story. It's fine. She was the first woman made with Adam, but instead of being made from his rib, she was made from the earth. So, like Adam was. So, they are often used, or she is often used in stories as more of Adam's equal, and so therefore she's got a lot more anger issues with where she is now. And we've seen that more. The more recent issues where she's arguing with the demon, and she is, there's a wonderful interaction with her in this current issue with Rachel's parents and her mother specifically, where she's so like, what, you think God is paying attention to you in the slightest bit? Like, this, you are fooling yourself if you think that he cares. And so her kind of sadness of not being able to pass on, and yet like the weight of what she's carried with her own past mistakes, I think is kind of beautiful. Like, I find her to be very sympathetic, even though she's psychotic.
Yeah, but so is now I can't remember his name, but the demon too. Like, what is his angle? It's this battle between these two forces of, I guess you could say, evil. But I think evil is too—it's too simple a term.
I find him much less sympathetic than Lilith. Like, Lilith's ready to be done. Lilith wants to die, and she can't. And that is there's a kind of eternal sadness in that. She is forever excluded from that because of her choices, and that. That's sad, but I guess we don't know enough about the motivations of the demon for me to. He's probably equally complex and delightful, but right now, if we're picking sides, I'm Team Lilith all the way.
Yeah, can I be too, even though I'm a man?
Yeah, totally.
Okay, even though she'll exact her revenge upon me.
She's gonna kill everybody. I didn't get the impression that she was interested in sparing anybody. It's just that the demon is using that as a jumping off point for killing, like, all the people in all the places, not just in Mason.
Right.
Neither of them is singling so far, though.
He is singling the very wicked.
Yeah, but he just claimed at the end there that he's, he set this stuff in motion for, in two generations?
Yeah.
Like, everybody dies. So far, just the evil isn't, like, that's not going to get you any points if, like, in 20 years you're just going to kill everybody anyway.
True. I guess so. Just temporarily. But regardless, I think we're both in agreement that this is something everyone should be checking out. And it's funny, in conversations earlier this week, people kind of assumed that this would be a book you wouldn't want to read.
Yeah, I'm not sure why, except that I clearly have a reputation for being a fucking scaredy cat, and that's cool. But I think that this is different. This is like Lock and Key. There are components that are frightening that are part of masterful world building, and I'm all for that.
It's not horror for the shock of it.
Correct. Yeah, we're going to talk about that one in a minute.
Yeah, you ready to move on?
I hate it so much, Aaron.
I almost wanted to do this first thing in the top of the show. I'm so excited for it. You know what time it is again. It's time for grief counseling. Andrea's reading The Walking Dead, and she's up to volume 5. Each week it gets harder and harder for her, but I told her the show is over if she stops, since I'm not above blackmail to get what I want.
Sometimes it's actually hard for me to decide which I hate more, you or the book.
Why can't you hate us equally? Why do you have to choose?
Fair enough.
Okay, so tell me what happens in this volume.
This is awful. I knew that there was a character coming along eventually that had this name because people have whispered it. But this is the first time that I met the governor.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm ready to be done now.
What happened with the governor?
So the stuff before when they went all Lord of the Flies in the prison, they've got nothing on the governor. It's absolutely sadistic and horrible and awful, and I'm not entirely sure that I'm comfortable talking about it. It's that unappealing to me. It's a madman with way too much power and the ability to keep that power through violence and horror, and Rick and Glenn and Michonne are victims of this situation. They went out to, what did they go to do originally?
Were they going to go get gas, helicopter?
Whatever. They had like a legitimate thing, and then they saw a helicopter, and so like that became like the whatever MacGuffin for this particular story. And in finding the helicopter, they discovered tracks and boot tracks and all scary foreboding. And I looked at the first picture and I thought, well, like the zombies got them. The zombies got the people from the helicopter. And I can't believe I'm going to say this, but I wish it was the zombies. So instead, it's the governor in this like little town that he has set up. And it's like torture porn. It's disgusting. And I'm really unhappy about it. I read it this morning.
It's not really torture porn, though, because it's more the, this is the part where it's like, what happens in a society that collapses?
You everything
have kind
goes
of
to
two
hell.
Choices.
I feel like we've covered that. I got that already. Everything goes to hell, and it's terrible. And the only people who are left are terrible, terrible people.
Well, it's also the how do you retain your humanity in
you
a world
don't.
That's lost
Clearly,
it.
Clearly, this particular volume is evidence of the fact that nobody has retained their humanity, and it's awful. It's awful. The level of depravity in this particular character, like, I am sure that you guys who have already read way past this are, like, laughing at me even more than usual this week, because I'm positive that we have just touched the tip of the iceberg of what the governor is capable of, but it's gross. It's, like, so overwhelmingly sad and depressing and terrible, and there's no hope, and it's just awful. Like, it's not about surviving anymore. It would be better to be dead. And how disturbing
well, then why
is that?
Why do some people go on and others give up?
I don't know, Aaron. I don't know. Because honestly,
this isn't the book.
I
mean, I'm talking in general. There's situations like this where you find that people are survivors and others are not.
I would not be one of those people. I know that. Like, it affects me so much, like to the core. It is so overwhelming for me to try to control my emotional response to this, and it's only getting worse because I don't understand how you would want to go on. It seems like it would be so much easier and so much more appealing to just give up. What are you working for? What are you fighting for? What are you living for when this is what living is like? It's awful.
But people do, and I think eventually at a certain point, especially in very like terrible situations, at terrible parts of the world, people survive, and it's part of life, and life just becomes that way. You find joys in the smaller things, that it's easy to become complacent when life is always easy, I guess, you know? And then how do you... I think the governor especially is very an interesting character in that he's rebuilt a part of society based upon, you know, the other is everyone who's not with us is against us.
Right.
The outsiders, you know, are against us.
Everything that you have, I want
community.
And I will take it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a might makes right. And I think there's parables in a lot of society. I mean, you know, maybe it's a political discussion or whatever, but you'll hear arguments that, you know, why are first world countries allowed to kind of impose their will upon the third world countries? And it's like, because the first world countries are the haves and the rest is the have nots. And that's a much larger kind of scale, but it goes down to the micro level, and we kind of see it playing out now in this arc.
Yeah. It's awful. I had a really hard time with it. I found myself, so I'm reading these digitally, and I have them like by volume, and each volume is about 137 pages, and mm-hmm. I found myself probably a dozen times checking to see how many more pages I had left. How much more of this do I have to endure? Because reading about what they are enduring is causing me trauma. And it's such a ridiculous thing because, as we've discussed, like, I just moved. I've got a pretty nice deal going here. I've got a really great kid. I don't have anything to be super worried about right now in my life. So in your little analogy, like, I'm the complacent one. I am the have. And I would rather just sit in my bubble here where I have, because reading about having not is causing me to have conniptions. It's an extreme example, I know that, but at the same time, it's so disturbing. It is so just wrong that, like, I don't know who to root for because everything is so broken. I don't know what, like, who are we trying to become at the end of the day? Individual characters, like, I take back everything I said about Michonne because I just want her to be at peace.
So that's interesting. That's what I was going to ask you. Like, last week, you didn't really like anyone. But now that the people you know are in a serious situation against people you don't, who are obviously not good people, you feel tied to them.
I do, but it's almost in a... man, I don't have a really great way to describe it. I know that there's nothing good will come of this. Nothing.
Maybe. We'll see. There's always next week. No spoilers.
Right.
Well, I don't envy you. This is a tough one.
You told me it was going to get worse. Everybody else told me it was going to get worse, too. This was definitely the worst of the batch so far. And you notice that I haven't really mentioned the zombies. There's a bunch more of those guys in this volume as well. It's just that
they're
not the only thing I'm afraid of anymore.
Yeah.
At a much different level than what was that volume 3 when, like, the shit hit the fan in the prison the first time. Like, this is so different. This is so much more traumatic for
me. It's sinister.
Sinister,
like, the governor's is more calculating, where in the prison it's more just chaos, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. The prison was survival in a very misguided way, but that was what they were that's what they were trying to accomplish, and it was instinct, and it was calculated and sadistic and just really awful. So mm-hmm. awful.
Yep.
I think that,
I'm excited
that
to talk about this more next week.
Yeah, but that about does it for me for this week.
That's all right. You can lay in your 1,000 thread count sheets.
I do not have 1,000
thread count. Take some Xanax. Put on your little eye shade.
None of these things are actually in my house.
Open up all the windows and the doors.
Well, that. I have that.
Mm-hmm. Have the pool boy prepare the pool for you.
I don't have that.
Forget all about your troubles.
I think I need to go, like, take a shower, though. I feel like, I wasn't kidding when I said to you before we started recording, like, I feel like I'm going to throw up. Like, I finished reading this right before we started because I was home alone last night, and I did not want to read it at home mm-hmm. at night by myself.
Yeah, that's a good call.
It turns out that wouldn't have helped or made it worse or whatever. Like, that wasn't the part. I was afraid about zombies. Remember back in that simpler time?
The halcyon days of just when you had to deal with zombies?
Yeah. Anyway. Mm-hmm. Let's be done.
Sounds good to me.
And look, we didn't even kill each other.
Yeah. This week.
Right.
There's always next week. Remember, if you're looking for show notes, information about leaving a nerd confession, and details about subscribing, it's all on the website at comicstherapy.com. Thanks for listening to Comics Therapy, everyone. Bye.
See you next week.